is Christmas Eve, babe. In the drunk tank, an old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a
Everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey, and this is the podcast which brings together everyone involved in innovating education. Happy Christmas, happy holidays, or just happy days, you choose. 2016 has been pretty but some good news on the horizon from the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy in collaboration with the Department for Education in the UK. Their EdTech Challenger workshop with over 50 in attendance, including moi, has now come back with some converted areas for improvement in EdTech, namely overarching government strategy and support, evidence and assessment, accreditation for EdTech learning, training and CPD in this area, data, exports, infrastructure and digital skills. These will be shared with ministers and some may end up in the form of government policy. I'll be writing a more extensive blog post on the details and suggestions around each area in the upcoming weeks and would love your thoughts on this. Now, this week's podcast is with Dominic Norrish, the Group Technology Director of United Learning Multi-Academy Trust of 60 schools in the UK. We hear from Dominic on the importance of driving value for money in procurement, the importance of scepticism when it comes to EdTech, the importance of change management when it comes to implementing new projects, the top three problems in existing education, and Dom's message to EdTech startups. Is this a Christmas tale of bar humbug?
It's just another work day, and any jackanapes who thinks else should be boiled in his own pudding. I say bar humbug.
Yes, it's very important to be highly sceptical about educational technology's ability to do anything, really.
Or a message of hope.
This past year has been one of great celebration for many.
I mean, there's a really good example of how you take technology, you think, can this help do something that we're already doing slightly better, or extend it, or make children do it for longer, and then realised incredibly well?
Let's find out.
Today's Monday.
Back from Web Summit and currently in Southwark, in London. And I'm here with Dominic Norrish, the Group Director of Technology at United Learning. So welcome, Dominic.
Hi, Sophie.
Just to kick off, first of all, thank you so much for joining. So, you know, I think a lot of people would be really interested to hear what you have to say in terms of your role and across 60 schools across the United Learning Academy chain in the UK. And my first question really was to find out a little bit more about your master's thesis. So I saw that's probably going back quite far. But exploring the basis of children's motivation to use ICT in school. And I thought that was quite an interesting place to start, because we often think about, you know, perhaps how do we engage the teachers to do this, or, you know, what's the efficacy behind it? But actually, you know, what's the children's motivation is an alternate question and way into this. So I thought we could kick off with
going back a fair way. Yeah, 2007.
Yeah.
I think you're probably the second person to read it. let my mum know what you thought.
Yeah.
well, fundamentally, what that found was that children, according to the multiple surveys that I did and paired interviews and all sorts of other mixed methodologies, the thing they value most about technology was, could loosely be described as agency, really. The power that it gave them over how they learned and what they learned, it made them much more adult in the domain of adults. So school is something that traditionally has been controlled by grown-ups and done to children. It's a gross simplification, but that can be how it feels. And technology breaks that a little bit. So back in, you know, almost 10 years ago, children who were using technology that I spoke to certainly valued that as a massive motivator.
Very interesting. For the sake of people listening, your own journey to your role started off in education, so going up to the level of ICT manager, then working in industry, so on that side of things, and as a consultant in ICT, and now as Group Director of Technology. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about
what experiences you picked up along the way and what your current role encompasses.
Yeah, I've had a weird, varied career, which has perfectly suited me for the role I'm in now. And it would be hard to plan it, so it's lucky that I just made random choices and ended up where I am. So I'm a trained primary school teacher. I started life teaching year five in a middle school, probably four of the best years of my career, certainly some of the most memorable. Worked my way up into various different responsibilities within school, as you do, as you grow. Taught at secondary all the way up to A level as well, and increasingly technology. Even though I'm a history graduate, ended up as a deputy head by the end of I suppose my first time in schools. If I'm really honest, I did it for 4 years and I thought, I really can't be a head teacher. That looks really, really difficult. And I don't think I've got it in me. I'm not a natural extrovert. All the things you need to be a head, I didn't think I had in me. So I moved sideways. I became an IT consultant in education. This was at the time when the government had some money and was spending it on schools. I don't know if you remember that. It was building new academies, and there was something called Building Schools for the Future. So I was advising schools on what they could possibly do with technology and how to do it, helping run procurements, and I learned a huge amount there. And then I went back to work for a couple of the schools that I'd been advising down in Hastings that were two of the last to be given money by the government before the axe came down in 2010 on all that funding. And that was the Hastings and St. Leonard's Academy Trust. I worked there for 18 months, some of the toughest times I've ever had, really, kind of 16-hour days working alongside builders and trying to be scrupulous in how we got value for that money, because we knew this was a once in a generational investment. It just wasn't going to happen in that town again. And the things we were doing in that time, I worked very closely with a very talented friend of mine called Mark down there. The money we were spending wasn't going to come again, so we had to make sure it made the maximum impact, and that's why that was such a demanding period of my life. And then from there I moved to United Learning, which, as you say, is a multi-academy trust. Well, really, it's an umbrella group for of schools, some of which are independent fee-paying schools, and most of which, about 40-something, which are academies. And because of, as you've picked up on, my career is fundamentally about, well, I started off as a teacher, moved into school leadership, did some consultancy, which exposed me to kind of project management and procurement, and also the pure IT side of doing that. It gave me this strange, unique, but quite useful background for the job I've currently got, which is a hybrid, really, of helping schools understand how to use technology well, so providing advice and guidance there, but also some very traditional IT things, keeping the lights on. It's not me, does it? It's my team. But I'd say the big things that we're doing in IT terms at the moment are making sure malware doesn't stop our schools from operating, making sure that teachers have time saved by being able to access a really useful intranet which puts English teachers together with other English teachers. Kind of simple things like that that can make a real difference.
Going back to your role in Hastings then, so how did you make the most of that money? How did you decide, okay, this is going to be value for money, and what projects came as a result of it?
Okay, so, well, firstly, we made sure that we held the IT contractor to account. I heard through one of their subcontractors that in one of their meetings, one of the project managers had referred to me as a penny-pinching bureaucrat, and he meant it as an insult, and I took immense pride in that because I was constantly challenging them on price. But I can see why he would have said that from his perspective, to be fair. Alex, if you're out there listening, I miss you. So we made sure that we hammered people on price. We made sure we didn't spend money on what I would call kind of vanity IT, things that sound like a good idea, that seem interesting, but actually, you know, in your heart of hearts aren't really going to be used that much. So, you know, huge green screen TV studios or virtual reality domes and things. There are lots of things like that on the market which aren't well suited to education. They're not bespoke for our market. They're just bolted on by companies trying to sell them elsewhere. And one of the things I've learned is that technology in schools generally fails in terms of a change project. And that's a kind of depressing and sweeping generalization to make, but it's kind of true. Most technology that's put into schools tends to not be used particularly well. And that is generally the case because the people who put it in don't stick around. Maybe that might be one of the things, or the there isn't enough leadership capacity at the school to make use of it, or generally the teachers are just overwhelmed with the accountability work that they're doing. I knew that as someone who didn't live in Hastings, I probably wasn't going to be there for 10 years. So we made sure that the technology was really simple. So, for example, we had these in the academies. They designed these big open plan. They were called honeycombs. They were, I would describe them as being kind of 30 by 30 square meter small halls surrounded with classrooms all around the fringes. And they were supposed to be kind of schools within schools model. So the whole of that kind of mini school could come together there. We could have spent lots and lots of money on very clever AV in there and not left enough to do other things. But we made sure that knowing that the history of school build projects like that is that people tend to build walls in them after a couple of years and turn them back into classrooms. The AV we put in there was mobile. It was these things called vertables at the time, which were convertible, kind of interactive whiteboards that you could turn horizontal as well as vertical. They encouraged collaboration. They weren't too expensive. And when the building changed, as it was inevitably going to do, they were redeployable into classrooms.
So one of my questions is, you're speaking at BETS in January coming up, and the panel that you're speaking on is around whether leadership within multi-academy trusts or umbrella organisations such as United Learning, whether that version of leadership requires different skills and different leadership to say if you're outside of that structure. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that from the ICT perspective.
Well, I think it's quite rare that an organisation like mine has a role like mine. My CEO, John Coles, he took a risk appointing me because most MAT chief executives would appoint, you know, kind of straight IT person who would, as I say, keep the lights on, make sure there are no viruses, do a solid job of making sure business as usual could carry on without disruption. I'm, as I said, a kind of hybrid technical educationalist, and John's vision is that we should be using technology well for teaching and learning, and that's the thing he's most interested in, which is why my role exists. And it doesn't exist in all multi-academy trusts, and the reason is there's very few people like me, I guess, who've got that background. One of the things that is most often missing from people coming out of schools, and something if people wanted to work at this in this kind of organization, they'd probably do well to get some commercial experience. That's really been very valuable to me, because a lot of what multi-academy trusts do to save schools money is effective procurement, and that's experience you tend not to get in schools. I mean, people become teachers and then assistant heads and then head teachers, and rarely do they have any kind of real experience of procurement because the role just doesn't offer it. So that's one thing I would say is essential to this kind of role. But also the other thing that this kind of level of leadership requires is, firstly, humility, and that's an awful thing to say, sorry, because it's usually said by people who are really not humble. I'm not trying to claim I am. But if you're leading on technology, the first thing you've got to do is just realise, accept and embrace the fact that you know nothing, really, compared to almost anyone in any niche that you could talk to. You might know a tiny bit about a lot of things, and my knowledge is, you know, a mile wide but half an inch deep, and you've got to embrace that, really. If you try and claim and be an expert, then you're just on a hiding to nothing, and there's quite a lot of kind of fake expertise out there. And once you've kind of come to a psychological position that allows you to accept your ignorance as just being the nature of the job, then you're in quite a good position to take advice from other people. And there's usually in every school and every other part of the organisation, people know a lot more about you, about the things that you're trying to do. So that puts you in the right frame of mind for working with a very diverse and capacious set of schools. The second thing that I find really valuable is being sceptical, because a lot of the job, I think, is avoiding the temptation of making, again, come back to this word vanity, you know, big decisions that you think are the right thing, because generally speaking, they're not. You may be representing multiple schools, but rarely will their interests align exactly enough for one person to decide on the way forward. So there's an awful lot of scepticism to be applied to what people try and sell you, and a huge amount of consultation to do. You really do need to work through others rather than see this as a as a role to do unto others.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, one of my questions was going to be actually, from your perspective, do you make procurement decisions that go across all of the schools, or do you delegate those to the schools?
Very rarely would we make a decision to buy one thing that all schools used. Very, very rarely. Because as I said, generally, they've got different needs. And even if they didn't, let's say we had somehow assembled a group of very similar schools, you can bet your bottom dollar they wouldn't see themselves as being similar. So a single decision made centrally would be passively at least resisted. And I can't say I blame them. When I was in a school, if my local authority had said to me, right, you're all doing this, my natural reaction was always to say, well, I'm not, because actually this is what we need to do as a school. These are our priorities at the moment. So if we end up identifying something across the group that is best done in the same way by everyone, and a good example of that might be our approach to assessment in this life after levels, if we identify that as being a thing that we all need to do the same for lots of good reasons around just, you know, in that example, getting data into one place, making sure that people are moderating their work effectively and that assessment practices are as good as they can be, then we take our time to try this out in a small way, to then scale up to maybe one sector. So in our case, we're going with a single product for assessment recording at primary first, and we are trialing it in a more extended way at secondary, because that's it's a sector, I think, where practices are more varied, and we're getting consensus from schools that actually this one product could do the job that 30 schools are all doing in a different way. That's really quite hard to achieve. So slowly and through talking to others, really. Ever so occasionally, we will buy the same thing for everyone when it genuinely is the same thing. So we take that approach with licensing to Microsoft, for example. Mm. We have a single supplier for iPads because they're essentially just a commodity. No one really cares where they come from. They care about paying they care about not paying much for them. So we don't take a very top-down model. However, other mats do. I note, I won't name names, but there's a multi-academy trust not a million miles from here. We've just moved over to a kind of managed service for IT and saving, I think the figure being banded around is like 1.5 million a year. Good luck to them. I'm sure that sounds great.
And you mentioned collaboration. So I'm guessing some of the people that you have to work very closely with, as well as, you know, the head, are if you have a head of data or the school business managers.
So, yes, school business managers are very, very influential stakeholders in every school. And generally speaking, they're managing the network manager, generally speaking, and sometimes, as you say, the data managers. And it is through people like that good decisions are arrived at and better systems are set up. So they are too often, unfortunately, in primary schools, those roles don't always exist. That's one of the issues around making primaries more efficient. And in secondary schools, they can have this kind of huge portfolio of things. They're trying to run, you know, half the staff. They've got a job of similar scale to the head teacher. But I think we recognise very clearly here that that's where the expertise is. Those people know an awful lot about how to run a school really, really effectively. So, yes, we try and work through business managers as much as possible.
So one person I met last week at Web Summit was a professor from MIT. And the sort of resounding message I got from the end of the interview with him was that his fear was that EdTech was sort of a sort of chase to the bottom in terms of quality. So as we use EdTech to save money, so goes out the window the potential quality of educational provision and services. I don't know what you think about that and whether that's a kind of valid fear or not.
I think it's... yes, it's very important to be highly sceptical about educational technology's ability to do anything, really, particularly to offer the same quality as face-to-face classroom teaching can. And that's one of the things we have been experimenting with. We've got a project called United Classroom, which is our virtual sixth form, where we are using great teaching from a couple of our schools to offer, at the moment, physics and economics A levels to children who go to a sixth form where those, for whatever reason, economic or staffing, where those A levels can't be offered. Now, in absolute principle, it's a great idea, and there's no reason why it shouldn't work. And technically, it's pretty easy to make work, and we use G Suite, I think it's called now. Let's just call it Google Docs for ease. I'll be struck off, won't I? We use G Suite to deliver that curriculum. What we find, though, very quickly, is that to do it well requires extraordinary teaching. So you really have to be one of the best teachers with this. Again, very hard to find a confluence of skills of being, you know, an absolute brilliant expert in physics and able to manage two desktops at the same time and multiple windows and deal with disembodied voices coming at you asking for help. It's really tough, much tougher than teaching face-to-face, I would say. When you are teaching face-to-face, you've got so many levers available to you, you know, eye contact, going silent, to my shame, I'll admit, occasionally slamming a door.
Used to have nails on the board.
Nails, oh, that's right, okay.
Another level.
Yeah, I never had the nails for that. But all of that stripped away from you as a teacher in a virtual environment. Even getting children to do their homework, you don't bump into them in the corridor because the corridor's 200 miles away. So it's really difficult to make work, and absolutely, I'm certain that the best way of teaching those children physics is to have a good physics teacher in their school. So in no way do we think this is better than that, but where that doesn't exist, where we can't do it, then it is better than nothing. So the benefits are that we're starting to realise is that children who would otherwise not be able to go and do physics at university from certain schools, they're going to go and do that. So it's quite life-changing, but it's really tough. The other thing that's really tough is that I think as adults, and this is an interesting thing to feed into the educational technology question you started with about 10 minutes ago, is that as adults we assume a level of independence and competency and just ease and confidence in children's technology skills that's a false assumption. It's this whole myth of the digital native, which obviously is ridiculous, but in all the children that I've spoken to over the past couple of years of United Classroom, I think I've met one or two who I would say knew as much as any of the adults involved. They all struggle to move from the physical to the digital. They struggle with having all the support taken away from them that they've learned to cope with in the previous 11 years of physical face-to-face teaching. And those kind of slick social media skills that they may display just do not translate into a natural ease of working in an online environment. It's something that's as novel to them as it is to teachers.
I'm so glad you said that about digital natives, because I heard someone recently say, you know, they're born digital, and you're like, no, really, they're not. Like, I've kind of seen someone a few days old. They didn't strike me as particularly digital.
No, they're born with digits, 10 if you're lucky. Yeah. Or do I mean 20? I'm not a biologist. I think it's just the fingers, isn't it? But yeah, even Prensky would say that whole phrase has been hijacked. Mm-hmm. And he never really meant it. It's a useful metaphor, but nothing more than that.
Yeah. Interesting. So, okay, there's going to be a lot of people listening in from either EdTech startups or scale-ups and beyond. You obviously mentioned your scepticism and a healthy scepticism. What would your message be to them? Like, what's actually valuable, or what would you say if they're trying to engage with schools and struggling?
I don't know why people would necessarily enter the EdTech market if they weren't ready for a real kind of uphill struggle. It's crowded. I went to a summit, the Global EdTech Summit, last week at the City Hall here in sunny Southwark, and there were a bunch of EdTech entrepreneurs there. I'd have to say, and I don't mean this nastily, but kind of complaining at how crowded the marketplace was to another bunch of EdTech entrepreneurs who wanted to take their place on stage. It's really hard to sell because there's too many people selling stuff. And schools are, because of this, absolutely exhausted by the amount of people who are trying to contact them with the answer to all of their problems. So what I would say to people who want to enter that market is make sure your product actually does solve a genuine educational problem. Start on that with that focus. Please, no more websites to keep children entertained with simple maths problems. I mean, if you want to look at that thing done well, take a look at Colin Hegarty's maths product, which is genuinely about helping children understand how to do something and adapting, and then telling teachers about how hard they've tried, not just if they got the answer right. I mean, there's a really good example of how you take technology, you think, can this help do something that we're already doing slightly better, or extend it, or make children do it for longer, and then realised incredibly well, with a lot of emphasis on the detail, really, and unsurprisingly by a former teacher.
And what would you say are the top three problems that need solving in education?
Just the top three? Wow. Okay. So I'd say that literacy is the biggest, most pressing one. And technology is rarely focused on that because it's so subjective. It's much easier, you know, to design a service that tells you what a binary type of question, like, you know, 5 + 5 is right or wrong, than if someone's using semicolons correctly. So if anything that is aimed at supporting children's interest in reading and in writing, and genuinely helping them to do that, it's good. So I've been impressed with the likes of Pobble, for example, which is squarely focused at providing children with an audience for their writing and giving them an incentive. And similarly, there's something called A Tale Unfolds, which I've always quite liked their approach as well to supporting literacy. But it is, I don't know the stats on this, I'm sure someone could look it up, but I bet for everything that supports English, there's 10 things supporting maths. And that's the biggest issue for me.
Okay, and another question in terms of, I mean, you mentioned it being a crowded market. What I've picked up on is this tension between investors who are obviously helping fund these innovations come through, and they're very much focused on scale. So what will scale? And is that, you know, something that can scale internationally, or is it in terms of the size of the potential markets? If you look at higher education institutions in the US, lots of investment going into that because they're bigger, say, than primary schools or nurseries and that kind of thing, in terms of the number of people going through them as one unit, if we put it like that, versus what perhaps teachers always say they want, which is personalization. So, you know, they actually want to be able to tweak whatever is constructed. They want to make it personal to their needs, as you just mentioned. And also, if we look at impact, there is evidence to show that actually it's at the early years stage of things where you can make a difference, whereas the investment doesn't seem to be currently in that area. I don't know if you've also noticed this, or, you know, that to me seems to be one of the problems that we need to work through, because there is a big difference in what the investors want and what the actual end users want, and as a result, perhaps, yeah, we're missing the mark.
So I think the UK ed tech scene is definitely focused on export, and quite rightly. The domestic market is small and shrinking. Schools have never had less money, or that's how that feels at the moment. And it's a huge challenge for schools to continue to afford the things that they really need to afford, which is really high quality teaching. So I think there's going to be more and more schools spending less and less money of their disposable money, really, on educational technology, and they're going to think really hard before investing. So, yeah, the sector's right to look outwards. However, looking outwards comes with its own compromises and challenges, and you end up making products that are pretty anodyne and fit every market, but no one particularly well. It's interesting that you mentioned personalization there. My take on the word personalization in educational technology is different from yours. So you were talking about teachers being able to bespoke stuff to their, which is true. Every teacher, and I was exactly the same, you get some great resource and you think, oh, that's pretty good, but actually I want to change this.
I want to pimp it up.
Yeah, well, it just doesn't quite suit my 9-year-olds. That is true for teachers, but if we take the word personalization in terms of pupils and learning, that's the great unfulfilled promise of educational technology, really. It's always held out this golden dream of an adaptive system that will be different for everyone who's using it, that will keep every learner in their, you know, zone of proximal development, Vygotsky would have called it, so that you are learning at the optimum rate. You're just on the edge of what you're capable at, and it understands where you're at, and it's pushing you further. And that's the dream, and we're nowhere near it. And I can't, well, it will take a breakthrough in of dramatic proportions to make the current educational technology that I'm seeing capable of doing those things.
And are there any schools or other people, so peers of your own, that you rate in terms of their approach to education innovation, or, you know, how they may be implementing, even if it's small things within their schools, that make a big difference?
Yes, plenty, and probably names that won't surprise you. So if you wanted to see leadership at a school level in educational technology done brilliantly, you couldn't go far wrong looking at what Jose Picardo's doing. He's a well-known name and voice in the UK and internationally. Perhaps less talkative about himself, and Jose will smile at himself to hear me say that, so don't worry, would be Daniel Edwards at Stephen Peirce Foundation, who is, for my money, one of the most innovative educators, PE teacher, who has routinely for the past kind of 5, 6, 7 years deployed technology to make him better and then his whole school better in multiple ways. And he's always at the edge of trying to find out what, and in his case it's iPads, what iPads can do to really add value to the experience of the children at his schools. So those are two who I've worked with in the past. You know, to claim an interest here, I like them, they're friends, but yeah, they're also really good.
Okay, and then are you reading anything in particular? You mentioned theorists before. Are there any particular influential sort of theorists that underpin your educational beliefs, or are you reading anything that you'd like to recommend to others in this space?
So I'm a constructivist, as you probably worked out, at heart, and I can't really understand why you wouldn't be that, but that's because I haven't read widely enough. One of the things I'm reading at the moment to challenge my thinking is Edie Hirsch. I can't remember the exact title of the book, but it's Things Every American Should Know, so it's the kind of the knowledge is power seminal text, all about cultural capital.
Yeah.
And making sure that children know the things that our society, and in his case American society, thinks that they need to know to thrive. And that's part of my education I missed out on. So there's a book that was written in I think the late 80s, back when I was at school myself, and it wasn't the education I experienced at all, really. I experienced a very progressive education, even in the state sector in the kind of 80s and 90s, where, yeah, obviously it was based around knowledge and demonstrating that in exams, but there was an awful lot of it was about exploring ideas and thoughts and project-based, what you'd call project-based learning these days. That's a big hole in my cultural understanding.
So actually going back and filling in the content knowledge and... it seems to be to me to be a constant balancing act between what you would describe as project-based learning versus learning the content.
I think that's a bit of a false dichotomy, really. As you've explained it, but just in general terms in the education sector, I think most people try and do a bit of both, because yeah, it's quite important to understand the facts and then to apply them in some way. And there isn't really, no one's forcing you into a choice between the two. But it's quite easy to write journalistic articles about that choice, isn't it?
Well, and so, I mean, at the moment I'm seeing a lot about you mentioned journalistic articles, there's a lot of writing around automated automation of jobs and which future skills we'll need if XYZ goes, becomes obsolete. And I've seen quite a lot of teachers pushing back on this as a potential narrative through which tech companies or ed tech companies can sort of solve that by saying, these are the skills you'll need and this is a way you can learn those skills. Do you look at that with your cynical hat on? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, they don't use it as a way of saying you can solve these skills. They hold it up as a kind of stick. I say they, so the technology world often starts its presentations with, our children today in 5 years' time will be 47% of them will be doing jobs that don't exist yet. I mean, what kind of crazy statistic is that, and where the hell does that come from? But it's held up as a kind of, you must engage in change right now, and if you don't, you're letting people down. So it's a kind of rhetorical tool to get people to engage in the debate. So yes, jobs are changing all the time. Mine didn't exist 5 years ago, but it's got, not because technology has made it possible, just because culture changes and the industry changes. And what happened? Well, slowly and in small, imperceptible ways, organisations alter to take account of that, as will education, as will children. If you want to talk about, you know, massive technological revolutions that put people out of work, I mean, that happened in the 19th century and society adapted. And we are, you know, that is now seen as a golden age of Western society, despite the fact that there was huge disruption. So, yeah, I'm just massively cynical about jobs disappearing. I'm sure automation will increase. I can't ever see, I think, come back to this point, I can't ever see a computer or a version of a non-human doing anything like as good a job of teaching, such a nuanced and socialized thing to do, and it is all about relationships, that I'd be astonished if in our lifetime we saw it done well. But then that might just show the limits of my vision and understanding, who knows.
Two final questions. How can people contact you? And then also, how do you relax outside of firewall issues and engaging leadership?
So I'm probably easiest to contact via Twitter. So I'm at Dom Norrish, N-O-R-R-I-S-H. And how do I relax? You mean, what do I do in my personal life?
Yes.
So I run marathons, did Berlin a couple of months ago. I write. I've just finished writing a historical novel for young adults under a pen name, you'll be glad to hear. You don't need to search for that one. What else do I do? I rambling conversations with educational technology journalists tends to relax me.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't forget, if you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe on iTunes or any other podcast player to get every episode instantly. Next week, Hannah Wilson from Women Ed on launching her new school headship in Oxford focused on STEAM. And we also have upcoming episodes from Microsoft and the British Dyslexia Association on supporting learners with dyslexia and uncovering their amazing ideas in new ways. Have a great day with your friends and family, and see you back here soon.
I wish you all a very happy Christmas.